from the intersection of technology and public accounting.
It's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
Welcome to Tech2Go for January 2007. This edition is brought to you by the CPA Technology Advisor. Visit cpatechadvisor.com for all the latest independent reviews, educational webcast programs, and a free productivity survey for your firm. Your host for Tech2Go is Greg LaFollette. He is the executive editor of the CPA Technology Advisor, and he also serves as the senior manager of tax and technology consulting for Eide Bailly. He is an accomplished professional who holds the CPA and CITP credentials and is uniquely qualified to help firms navigate through the technology maze to find practical solutions that work. And now here's Greg to introduce you to the rest of the team on Tech2Go.
This is Greg LaFollette introducing you to our inaugural version of Tech2Go, our podcast of what we will describe as indeterminate length. We expect to go for about an hour. I have three guests with me today. I'm thrilled to introduce first my longtime friend from the Pacific Northwest, Brent Goodfellow. Good morning, Brent.
How are you, Greg?
Great. Thanks for joining us. Brent, you and I first met, if I would recall, in probably 1987 or so. Is that about right?
That sounds about right.
You're one of the few people I know who has more initials behind your name than you do in your name, and you actually have a long name. So you carry a lot of certifications. You are first a CPA and a CITP, correct?
That's correct.
Practiced for a long time, former president of the Oregon Society. So you've certainly done your professional side. And you practice now. Tell me a little bit about your firm out there in Portland.
We have about 25 people altogether. We're listed as 21 in the top 25 firms in the state of Oregon, and they do that according to size, which is kind of a crazy thing. But
sure.
We have a traditional accounting and tax management consulting type of practice on one side, and we have an IT consulting practice, which is my responsibility to manage,
right,
on the other side.
So years and years and years ago, you kind of fell in love with a company out there up in Redmond, and you were talking to me about Windows 3.1 way back in the early days, telling me to buy Microsoft stock, Of course, I didn't believe in Windows, and I didn't buy the stock, so I was probably wrong on both counts. you've really gotten into the technology side. You are an MCSA, an MCSE, an MCT. What's an MCT, Brent?
That is Microsoft Certified Trainer. So it's a certification for training in Microsoft technologies.
Right, right. And you spend a pretty good amount of time immersed in the technology side, with a special flavor towards the technology implemented in small and medium-sized accounting firms. You're actually the technology back room for a fair number of small firms all around the country, right?
That's correct.
I've run into firms that you work with. I'm thinking of firms in New York and in Florida and in Texas and you're in Portland.
That's correct.
I guess the miracles of modern technology, you can do that.
That's right.
Well, Brent, I very much appreciate your being here. We've been fortunate enough to have you writing your column in the CPA Technology Advisor. Plug your column.
It is called Accountant Tech Talk.
Okay.
And it appears 8 times a year, every issue of the CPA Technology Advisor.
And you've been writing that since back in about 2000 or so, right?
Sounds about right.
Okay. Well, we certainly enjoy having you in. I'm proud to call you, I guess, a colleague there, and we've been partners in a couple of businesses over the years, and done a lot of things together, and I certainly appreciate your having you here. Our second guest is Dave McClure. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Greg. Always a pleasure to be with you again. And hi, Brent.
How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well.
Thanks for being willing to join us. Now, Dave, you're speaking to us from the other side of the country. You're out in Virginia, right?
I am in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, looking out at a gorgeous day as the sun comes up over the mountains here.
Well, the sun's coming up over the cornfield here in South Dakota, and there's a lot of snow on it, so don't go too far with that gorgeous view, or you'll have me camping out on your doorstep. Now, Dave, you have written to and spoken to and been involved with accountants and accounting technology for a long time, but you're a poser. You're not an accountant, right?
No, exactly right. And it's still kind of amazing to me I got into this industry. I'm a techno geek, and I'm proud to be called a geek. I wandered into the accounting industry in 1990 when I became the marketing director for a little tax and accounting software company.
Uh-huh. And since then, tell me about USIIA.
Well, the USIIA is something that I started in 1994 to be the primary trade association for the Internet here in Washington. And for the past 12 years, almost 13 now, we've been deeply involved in most of the policies that affect the Internet, from taxes on your access to copyright issues and right up to date to net neutrality.
Sure. Okay. Well, those are certainly important kinds of things, and Dave, you have written your column for the CPA Technology Advisor almost as long as me. You've been around for a long, long time. Bleeding Edge, very popular column. Tell me a little bit about what you write about.
Sure. Bleeding Edge was started as an opportunity for us to range a little bit outside of the standard software and hardware technologies for accountants, stuff that is, first of all, on the bleeding edge, kind of new and edgy stuff, but also stuff that accountants make use of that don't fall within what we normally consider accounting technology, so that we've gotten into everything from PDF file formats and the introduction of Windows 95 to things a little more esoteric, like cell phones and big screen TVs.
Right, and always fun stuff. Now, you mentioned taxes, and we've been paying taxes on those dreaded cell phones for a long time. There's a bunch of money sitting around, and there's a quasi-government agency that's set up to oversee what happens with that money. And I just saw the other day, I was very, very pleased to see, a press release indicating that you had been named to that board, the USAC board. And this is pretty heady stuff. You were named by the director of the Federal Communications Commission, right?
Yes, I'm very pleased with the appointment to the Universal Service Administrative Corporation. They're the company that sort of oversees how the federal government gives away $7.3 billion to schools and libraries and hospitals and to help get telecommunications services out to areas that otherwise wouldn't be well served. And I'm very excited about the new challenge there in helping to, especially to bring broadband to America. So really a challenging situation, and I'm delighted Chairman Kevin Martin at the FCC made the appointment.
Well, congratulations to you. Maybe Brent and Randy and I should start a school or a hospital. That's probably not a good idea. Congratulations to you.
Well, you're welcome to, but I don't directly hand out the money, so
well,
you might be good,
Greg. Drat the luck. Our final guest, and thanks very much for being with us, Dave. our final guest, and I suppose for many of you, I've saved the best for last. My longtime friend Randy Johnson, who if I refer to as an Uber geek, would take that as a compliment, right, Randy?
I think that'd be probably appropriate. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Thanks so very much for being here, Randy. You've been one of the longtime thought leaders within the profession as it relates to technology. A long time, almost 20 years straight now, speaker at the AICPA Tech Conference.
Yeah, that would be correct, Greg, and actually some before even that in the CPA industry.
Right. So, around for a long, long time. Tell me a little bit about what you guys do, and I say you guys, you and your partner Val Steed run K2 Enterprises, which is you've engineered now to become certainly the largest influence or influencer of CPAs as it relates to technology. Tell me a little bit about what you guys do over there.
Yeah, as you know, and maybe some of the listeners know, we actually have two companies. One, K2, which produces
right.
about 800 face-to-face CPE seminars a year to around 40,000 CPAs in most states.
Schedule, you do most of those yourself, right?
The good news is, nowadays, no, but
right.
still do 50-plus. In fact, I think last year was a little over 70 face-to-face days, which is excellent because you get a chance to talk to people and listen to people about the needs that they have directly.
Sure.
Also have another business called Network Management Group, Inc., which is a regional value-added reseller network infrastructure type of company,
uh-huh.
which has been around for actually 20-plus years as well,
sure.
where we produce a product called Double Check, which is a spam control appliance, as well
exactly.
as a lot of...
Great product. I love it.
Yep. So, in any case, it's been a wonderful life so far. Looking forward to continuing to do it.
Well, I certainly appreciate you joining us and kind of rounding out our panel. We have visited about kind of what we want to do here and what our mission is, and we've named our recurring podcast Tech to Go, designed the name to kind of reflect what it is that we're trying to do, which is kind of take some of the information that we all have, make it a little bit more interactive. It gives us a chance to talk to one another, which is fun, and roll it up in a format that our readers and now listeners can put in a format that's a little bit easier for them to maybe to take with them, and maybe they'll even stick it in their iPod when they go out for a walk, and will not only make them smarter but will make them healthier. Wouldn't that be a great idea?
Yeah, I'm wondering if they can get it on their Zune.
Well, they could. Speaking of Zunes, it's probably a good segue into our first topic. I walked past the Zune booth. In fact, I happened to be with Brent as we were at CES last week, and we walked past this massive Microsoft booth, which had to be 15,000 square feet anyway, right?
Oh.
And over in one corner, there was a booth with four or five Zunes and a couple of very lonely product managers. And I tried to get Brent to go over and stand in front of the Zune so I could take his picture, but he wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't you do that, Brent?
Well, I don't know. I think that product is typical V1, and it's got all kinds of issues. There's so many, the chiefest of which, in my opinion, is there's so much in terms of digital rights attached to that product, and the fact that it doesn't even really work with Vista or Windows Media Player right now. So if you can't make a product you're selling work with your own software, that seems to be a problem in my mind.
Right. Well, the big joke at CES was, of course, that the biggest announcement at CES, Dave, was what?
Gosh, The biggest announcement at CES actually wasn't at CES.
It was the iPhone, right?
It was the iPhone, sure. It was in San Francisco. And all the press left on day three of CES to run over to San Francisco to cover that instead.
Well, I thought that was going to be the case, which is why I came into CES a little late, thinking that maybe the crowd would be a little less, which believe me, is not true. The crowds are simply overwhelming, and the whole thing is almost unnavigable. But there were still some fun things there, and Randy, I know you weren't either unable to make it or smart enough not to go. And I think it's probably the latter for those of us that were there. So I know you've heard a little bit about it. Any thoughts from anybody? What did you take away from CES? What did you like?
Well, I thought the big announcement, which was part of Bill Gates' keynote, and it wasn't that it was probably his last keynote. He said he was going to go take care of his foundations and work on infectious disease, but he announced a product which will be out later this year called the Microsoft Home Server.
Bingo. And
what's that?
Bingo. My favorite.
Yep.
Keep going. It's wonderful.
And that was his big thing. He did talk a little bit about the Zune. He said that they were on track to meet their goal to sell I think it was 100,000 units or something like that.
This is Dave. I thought he said 100 units. I would believe that they'd be closer to that, actually. But that's the cynic in me.
Well, he backed off in a more private type interview after his keynote and kind of indicated that they may not make that goal. So, I'd be surprised if they do. But the home server product is getting a lot of buzz.
Well, Brent, it's a fascinating product, and I want to talk about it a little more, but I don't see the buzz. Where do you see the buzz, other than you and I are talking about it, and Dave and Randy?
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with a guy by the name of Paul Thurrott. He does a podcast with Leo Laporte and his Win Supersite. It's just kind of breaking, and a lot of the tech people are trying to figure out what this product is. But
well, let's kind of run down the punch list for our listeners here. What is? I stood and looked at the physical box. Was there? Their launch partner is HP.
That's right.
But other people will get on the wagon here, and it's really software, but they're only gonna sell it with a box. You won't be able to buy the software and build your own. Is that right?
That's right.
Tell me about the box.
Well, it's a small appliance type device that's designed to sit on a home network.
It's about an 8-inch cube, right?
About an 8-inch cube. It's designed to be small and quiet so that it can sit in a home somewhere. It's designed to hold what most homes consider their most valuable data, which is digital photographs and music files, that kind of thing.
So it's a processor, right? So it's a computer. It's not just a NAS.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And they have built in some wizards that are very small business server-like, at least based on what I saw at CES, that allow non-technical home users to set up security on certain files. So if you want Johnny to have access to his folder but not the folder that Mom and Dad have access to, then a wizard walks Mom and Dad through this process to set that security, and they don't have to be technical to do that.
It's starting to sound like a network.
It's exactly what it's designed to do. And the other the big advantage, as I see it, is they have built in some of the code from Windows storage server, which will back up every PC on the home network. And it backs it up in such a way that if there's a DLL file, let's say, on all three machines, and it's exactly the same date on the file, the same version, then it will only bring in one copy of that file. And if one of those PCs goes down or loses a hard drive, there's a process built into the home server product that can restore that PC in a relatively short period of time.
So that's a full life to bit level restore. So it restores the data, the applications, the associations. So your machine comes back to exactly the state that it was prior to whatever event it was that you're restoring from.
That's exactly right. It's like an image of the
right.
of the hard
drive. So did Microsoft write this, or is that relicensed retrospect? Is it EMC stuff, or
it looks to me like they've taken code from a number of their other products. So they've taken Windows Server 2003 code. They've taken some of the storage server code. It looks like, although they didn't admit this at CES, they've taken some of the code from Small Business Server, and they've just kind of melded it together to support what they see as the needs of it, of a home user. And they did this based on some analysis that they did. 40% of homes now have more than one PC.
Sure.
70% of homes are completely digital when it comes to photographs, and of course music is going that way as well.
And 92% of small accounting firms have more than one computer too.
That's exactly right. And although this is called home server, there may be a lot of small accounting firms.
I think there's going to be a huge number of small accounting firms looking at this product. Now, in addition to that, I mean, there are four drive bays in there, and they didn't announce whether, you know, when HP rolls this out. As I talked to the product manager, and I said, you know, are these going to be in what, 1 and 2 terabyte versions, or what? He kind of indicated, I got the feeling that was about the right guess. Maybe a half a gig and a gig, a half a terabyte and a full terabyte, or maybe 1 to 2 terabytes, but somewhere in that neighborhood would be like the two versions that you could buy. But it also has a USB plug on the back that you could plug in, and an extended drive, so you could plug in another drive, and it uses that file extender technology. Does anybody know anything about that, how that works?
Well, a little bit. Again, it's the storage server code, and so what it does is plug in a USB drive into the home server, just expands the overall drive space by the size of the USB drive.
So if I've got a terabyte, and
that's
I
right.
plug in another 500 gig drive to it, and
yep.
then I go to my computer to look at it, I see not two drives, not a terabyte and 500 gig, but I see one and a half terabyte drive.
That's right.
Wow. Randy, have you seen anything on this? You know anything about it, heard about it?
You know, as a matter of fact, I'm fascinated listening to you and do not know more technical details than what
okay.
you're talking about today.
Well, it's there are a couple of other things. They made it a little groovy, not to be a 60s guy, but rather a Ray Ozzie guy. They made file sharing, internet-based file sharing. They built that in, so I could put photos of put one particular folder and share that with, for example, the three of you, and you'd all be able to see that particular folder via the internet. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so I've solved that. I've also what about the go to my PC type technology? Isn't that in there too?
It is, and again, this is very Small Business Server-like, so you've got a web interface that you log on to, and this becomes your home network, and once you log on to this web interface, then you get a view of all of your home PCs, and assuming they're powered on, then you can click on one of those home PCs, and assuming you have the rights to access it, you get a remote desktop session to that home PC from anywhere that has internet access and a web browser.
Wow. Dave, did you get to see this, Mark?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the interesting thing about this for me, Greg, is this clearly is not a home server. Most of the things that home users want to do, and I'm talking about your basic level home user, not your aficionado. This is really a small business server, and what I like about it more than anything else is they've merged the convenience of a home appliance into what essentially is going to be a great boon to accounting offices. Just the extensible hard drives and the central file storage and the ability to manage and back up all the computers into one place automatically gets us into a kind of workflow management solution on the hardware side that we haven't seen from Microsoft easily done in the past. So I'm really excited about it. I wanted to make a comment, though, Greg. The most exciting buzz at CES was not just about this, and it's one that I think a lot of people are overlooking because it right now seems such a home-oriented kind of thing, and that is the evolution of the Xbox 360.
Talk about
it. If you didn't see it, there were guys wandering around who had made it the Xbox 360 controller, the little game controller, with Windows Live Local, and were using it as a navigation system, wandering around Las Vegas. I talked to people there who have completely replaced their TiVo systems. They now have every television in their house, every piece of electronics in their house, fully networked, and it works. And this is something, by the way, that the set-top manufacturers have not been willing to do. If you look at your satellite box, for example, or your TiVo box, they've all got USB ports on them that do absolutely nothing,
right,
and there are no plans for them ever to do anything. I keep a close eye on Xbox 360 because I think that's going to be the home platform of the future.
Wow, now that's interesting. I have not, I will confess, I have not, I don't have a 360, I don't have a gaming platform. I've kind of, I guess, been afraid to buy one because I probably get addicted to it. You other guys, do you have one, Dave? Do you have one?
Well, you know, I guess I'll speak up on this one because, Greg, you really pointed out appropriately I wasn't at CES, but I'd like to make three or four comments, and then I'll probably bow back out. Because in my home, I had I have four children, two girls, two boys, and the youngest son, Dave, is quite literate. He's become a Linux guy and actually does Xbox Linux hacking. So in our home, we actually have the Xbox 360, which we purchased the first week it was out, actually the first day it was out. We have the PlayStation 3, which we were able to get the 60-gig version, and we have the Wii, which I wanted all three of those consoles running in the home so I could evaluate them. Plus, we've traditionally done the Microsoft way of integrating multimedia editions of XP so we can distribute both music and video across our home network. And in this particular case, of course, the Xbox 360 is headed down the HD, the high-definition replacement for DVD, and, of course, the PlayStation 3 is headed down the Blu-ray. So one summary comment that Dr. Bob Spencer and I came up with CES was just the whole new evolution in TV to 1080p plus 7.1 surround sound plus Blu-ray or HD, and I'm still favoring Blu-ray a little bit personally, but running that quality of video in your home is really helpful. Now,
and you must have been a Betamax guy too.
I appreciate that, but okay, no, man. I did miss the Betamax realm.
Yeah, at CES, they married those two, you know, the Blu-ray and the HD.
Yes, with the LV release. So, right, you know, this whole issue of high-resolution video from these units is really a nice step forward, and you've got to look at the consoles from both the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 as, you know, multi-appliances, not just game consoles, because they're doing far more. Web browsing through the Wii, web browsing through the PlayStation 3 are both very, very functional. And storage and playback of slideshows, so in other words, digital pictures on the PlayStation 3 or on the Wii, very, very functional. So these consoles are a major battleground. Of course, Xbox 360 has crossed the 10 million threshold, and so I'm actually pretty excited about it from that front. And at the risk of being a little distracting, the other thing that Dr. Bob and I talked about relative to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, was the lack of released products for portable users and for mobile six, because we were really looking for a new generation of cell phone pocket PC to actually be able to do the replacement. But no one would speak to Dr. Bob on the floor, and frankly, then we thought we'd be buying new cell phones in February, and it looks like we're just going to sit on them for a while.
Yep, I agree. I saw, of course, the 108-inch TVs were pretty astounding. That was new. There were, and I will say, there were a lot more booth babes there this year than I've seen in the past, which I just throw out because I happen to have noticed that. You know, call me crazy. There's some interesting technologies. You know, this induction technology they've been using it for years to charge your electric toothbrush. They had several booths there showing that technology, and this is available technology to charge like cell phones and PDAs and things. Just a pad, and you just throw it on there, and it charges. Kind of interesting stuff. And there was another technology. At first, I thought it was the same, but it's not. It's another company that's another technology that doesn't charge, but it powers using evidently the same technology that the Tesla tried to use, you know, 100 years ago when he and Edison were fighting about about how we were going to do this. But this is a technology that uses radio wave to power, and could be used to power very low voltage and very, very tight, like under a couple of feet. But it could power a keyboard and a mouse, so you wouldn't always have this problem of your keyboard and your mouse dying and needing to replace batteries. Anybody see those?
I didn't see those at CES.
Okay, those were just a couple of the things that stuck in mind. Dave, you loved the 360 thing. Anything else you saw, or are we about done with CES?
Yeah, I would make a couple of comments. I want to cycle back just a little bit to some of the things that Randy said.
Right.
First of all, Greg, would you mark down on the list, the next time we get together, let's talk about the really sad and sorry state of cell phones. As you know, this is one of my core issues, and the smartphone market in particular is becoming almost unbearable for users, and we probably need to talk about that a little more.
Sure.
I also want to make the point, you know, people are kind of laughing about Randy and his number of game consoles. Accountants, first of all, accountants aren't laughing about it. Not many people were around in December of 94 when they released Doom 2. And I did a little column early in 95 in the middle of tax season where I happened to mention that when your brain is fried after a day of doing tax work and you get home and it's midnight and you can't go to sleep yet, why not sit down and relax and kill a few aliens on Doom 2? And I was stunned by the number of accountants who were deeply into this game in the middle of tax season, using it as a way to just, you know, kind of cast off frustration and stress. So I think there are a lot of gamers out there in the accounting world. I know that probably runs counter to their public persona, but there are a lot of gamers out there and a lot of geeks. So I just kind of wanted to make that comment. And the other thing I wanted to say about CES, as delightful a show as it is, it's still 175,000 attendees. You know, I went over to look at the Zoom booth at Microsoft, I couldn't get within 10 feet of one of the displays because it was so packed.
Right.
Gosh, what a wonderful and horrible show.
You're exactly right. Just too many, too much, almost more than you can handle. Let's pop out of the CES thing, and we'll all be writing about this and talking about it for a long, long time. And after all, it has to last for a year, and I've still got a whole pile of literature here that I have to go back and look at. And I snapped a whole bunch of photos, just took a quick photo and said, I want to go back and look at this. Let's move on to Vista. You know, Vista was there, of course, in huge force, and Microsoft, everywhere you turned, it was the wow that was there. When you see it, then you'll say it, the wow thing. Randy, what's a small firm to do? Do we care about Vista?
You know, at this point, I'm going to suggest to small firms that we really don't yet.
Okay.
You know, the official consumer release, of course, is 11 days out, January 30th.
Exactly.
But the real key, I think, is application and driver incompatibilities. And for at least now, new machines that ship with Vista, I think, will cause more problems than they will solve.
Sure.
There's some very low-level technical problems, but a simplistic way of saying it's just driver support. For example, something that I consider fundamental to my ability to work effectively is the high-speed Sprint EVDO card. That card still doesn't have a driver available under Vista, as an example. So if I'm on Vista, I can't use my high-speed internet. We found other issues like that, and I just suspect that there's going to be unpleasant surprises on supporting printers, scanners, some other things like that. But even at a low level, there's a new networking technology. It's been around for a long time, but it's new to Vista. The server messenger block has been changed, which will cause the product not to be compatible with some sort of network technologies. And we think that's going to cause at least some issues. There's also a lot of other niceties about the things that we like. I like the speed of Vista, but there are things that maybe older applications were dependent on that have been removed from Vista. And again, it's probably time to step forward, but at least for now, it looks like the right business strategy through at least the first half of 2007 is to leave it alone, don't order new machines with it. That's what I think our fundamental position is still going to be.
So if a small firm right now, you know, machine dies, I got to have a new one.
Yep.
Your suggestion is, I mean, you won't be able to buy an XP machine.
Well, you know, the Microsoft did announce in the last 2 weeks that they would make available for purchase Windows XP and Office 2003 through roughly January of next year.
Okay.
And they've had this issue where March 15th is when they were intending to end the couponing program, and that date, to my knowledge, has not shifted. So between now and March 15th, I would order a machine with Windows XP and take the Vista coupon, and hopefully the couponing program will be extended.
So will the OEM still, am I going to be able to call Dell and Valentine's Day and order an XP Pro machine?
Yes, Microsoft did make the announcement to extend that. Like I said, it was sometime in the first 2 weeks of January here.
Okay. Well, Brent, talk to me a little bit. I know you know a lot about the driver issue. Tell me a little bit about the driver issue, and then we've got to come back to applications.
Well, Randy's right on, but one thing that Randy didn't say is that Vista is actually supporting a larger subset of drivers on release than XP did when it was released. And the thing that just...
So it's not as bad as the other guys have been.
Well, it's not as bad.
Not as bad as it was in the olden days.
Not as bad as when XP was released.
Okay.
We're moving from, you know,
it's damned by faint praise,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. The thing that just irritates the heck out of me is the whole application incompatibility issue is not Microsoft's fault. And frankly, you know, they changed the operating system, so you could argue that they're responsible for the incompatibilities. But they've been working on Vista for, you know, 5 years.
Right.
The fact that Randy's EVDO card doesn't work with Vista, it's not because Verizon or whoever his carrier is hasn't had access to the Vista code. It's because they've procrastinated writing drivers for an operating system that was certainly imminent and has been actually extended in terms of its release.
Well, in their defense, this has been a moving target. You know, I would have hated to have had them build a driver for the first proposed release.
Yeah, and that's typical Microsoft, right? They're constantly moving their release dates and things. But my goodness, the last year we've had a couple of betas and a couple of release candidates. So again, you know, you talk to somebody like CCH and they say, well, our development cycles didn't allow us to update our software to work with Vista, and they've announced that their products are going to be Vista compatible in quarter two of this year.
This is the real important thing. Now we've changed from drivers to applications, and for practicing public accountants, this is probably way more important, because I mean if you've got you buy a desktop machine or your machine for your office and it doesn't run EVDO, I guess you could live with that. But if you happen to be using ProSystem FX and CCH goes, well, I'm sorry, but we're not ready to run under Vista, now you've got a real problem.
Now you don't have a choice. And actually, you know, you kind of do have a choice. This is what I've done, because I've been running Vista, you know, for a year now, and in terms of production, when the code went gold late October, I actually built a machine and put Vista on it. And, you know, the new Intel hardware supports virtualization. So on this Vista machine, I have a virtual machine running XP, and that virtual machine runs everything that won't run on Vista.
Sure. Okay, well, let's take inventory. CCH doesn't support Vista right now. They've announced Q2, and I know how to talk developer talk. Does anybody know what Q2 means?
Yeah, it means Q4.
It means
June 30th.
We'll roll it out on the afternoon of June 30th. That's Q4.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, exactly. Now, over on the Thompson side, where is CSI, Brent?
I've tested virtually all the CSI products on the Vista platform. I'm not sure what their official position is, but the CSI products run just fine on Vista.
Everything runs okay, and obviously the Microsoft products run well, except the Zune. The Microsoft products all run. Over on the Intuit side, QuickBooks runs fine. I don't know about Lacerte. Does anybody know about Lacerte?
Yeah, Lacerte announced that they will not support Vista for the 2006 filing season. So
okay.
Essentially, they're kind of on the same program.
Sure. And that all kind of fits in with what Randy told us in the first place. This is not something that small firms ought to be jumping into. But if you've really got the itch, nothing wrong with buying a new machine right now, maybe for your home, getting used to it, playing with it. I mean, once people see gadgets and start really understanding what they are, don't you think people are going to fall in love with Vista pretty quickly?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
There's
the voice of reason.
No, I've been skeptical for a long time. First of all, what does compatible with Vista mean when Vista's going to come out in two different versions, 32-bit and 64-bit? Does that mean it's compatible with 32-bit or compatible with 64? There's no clue. And in fact, Microsoft is dodging this whole, and by the way, the difference between the two platforms is enormous. And Microsoft doesn't even talk about it. They like ignore it, go away boy, don't bother me kind of, go away kid, don't bother me stuff. And this is a critically important thing. They're also not talking about the resource requirements. I can tell you right now that there are HP computers being sold with the Vista compatible logo on them that don't run Vista. They don't have the horsepower. For one thing, it requires a 3D graphics card to run most of the versions of Vista.
Well,
they don't really
bother
with
that. Only the Aeroglass stuff, right?
I mean, why are they not talking about any of this more openly? I think it's going to be an unmitigated disaster. I think it's going to be far worse than what we saw with the introduction of Windows 95. And, Greg, that took 4 years for most accountants to actually get over, and for accounting developers. Because what do you develop for? 32-bit or 64-bit? How soon do you develop? How soon is your customer base going to go there? Because with a lot of the smaller accounting software firms, they were ready to move to 32-bit platforms, and their customers said, hell no, we'll leave you. So that's, I mean, it's a very difficult, I think, kind of transition that Microsoft is facing
sure.
with this new product, and the fact that they're doing, what, six different versions of it with different capabilities is only going to make it worse.
But think back now. Randy, you can chime in here a little bit. You know, if you go back at those other transitions, we were looking at places where software providers were much smaller, had much more their user bases were more fragile, more fungible, and now you know we're really down to a handful of providers, and the bases are huge.
Yeah, and you know, I think your attitude earlier, by the way, was correct, that I don't really think this is, quote, a Microsoft problem so much as a lot of the developers, in fact, just didn't try to do the development work. I think it actually is a simpler development than we have seen in the past from a developer's vantage point. But, you know, again, I didn't see the resources turned soon enough, so the practical matter is just things aren't ready to go. And I do love your virtual PC solution to make things work, because that's probably our best short-term bridge if we get caught. Realistically, I think Microsoft has made it easier for the developers to write interfaces, but I also do agree we're in this dead transition space of 32-bit, 64-bit, and I actually personally have stopped recommending 32-bit hardware in almost all situations. So again, this is like, whoa, wait a minute, that means laptops, desktops, is that a practical recommendation? Is that the right recommendation? I don't know. But I do know that for me personally, since I actually just bought a new replacement desktop and I'm waiting to buy my laptops, they're both going to be dual 64-bit on the laptop, and the desktop is a quad 64.
Sure. So, you know, you're really looking at, that's kind of a, can I call that maybe a short-term pain and long-term gain?
Yeah, probably. And I know that we won't get all the benefit. And I've been reading the reviews on, you know, hey, two 64-bit processors doesn't buy you a lot and four doesn't. But I got to tell you, the quad 64 is clearly outperforming the dual 64, clearly outperforming the 164 in my applications. So I suspect it will be economically justifiable for a lot more people over the next 1 year or 2 years.
That's, and those are 32-bit applications you're running on that hardware.
In many cases, I'll get a few 64-bits, but not a lot. So, again, watching for the publishers to produce us clear and true 64-bit solutions, yeah, I think in the life cycle of this box, I'll have most of the key applications running 64-bit.
That's a crazy amount of flop power there, isn't it? Just crazy.
Yeah, it really is. It's really, really pretty to watch. Yeah,
that's fun. Let's move on. Next, and really the same conversation is Office 207. You know, I've been running this for a while, and I mean, if anybody thinks this is, if there is a revolutionary change, this is. I don't know. I think it's revolutionary. What do you guys think?
I think it's revolutionary in that, you know, in the last couple of releases of Office, we've had a lot of changes under the hood, and the changes in Office 2007 are front and center because the user interface is completely different.
They sure are, and in many cases easier, but in a lot of cases harder. Easier to find if you've never been there, harder to find if you knew where it was. Is that fair?
Yep, that's really fair.
Dave, you using 07 yet?
Yeah, I am. And the good news and the bad news, what I really, really like about it, you know, is that they're kind of pulling together some workflow standards for you. They're really kind of, I mean, making it easier to save documents in PDF format, for example. There are some quirky things that still make no sense to me. they replaced Microsoft Front Page with not one but two different programs that go in two different directions.
The product
and
wasn't any good to start with.
Pardon me?
That's true.
It's just, you know, in my mind, there are still a lot of small accounting firms that are running their own websites and trying to manage their own websites. This is going to make it harder for them, not easier. Once again, now we've got seven different versions to deal with. For some reason, the instant messaging module, which I think would be very helpful to people, is only being sold in the version that goes to their volume licensees, not to everyone else. The front page replacements aren't even being sold as part of the Office suite. You've got, and Groove is the instant messenger thing, you've got this new Office communicator, which again, I'm sorry, Groove is the peer-to-peer, Office communicator is the instant messenger. Neither one of them available to most Office users, when clearly those are, I think, really valuable communication technologies. And in the terms of instant messaging, where they'd make a lot, I think, a lot of inroads in small offices, not even being sold to them. So we have to fall back and remember that this is Microsoft marketing at work, and they're champions at shooting themselves in the foot when it comes to marketing what are otherwise exemplary products. I like it very much, love it, will recommend it, but there are some quirks.
Well, you know, on the Office Communicator, which we use and, in fact, have done consolidations, there's a different word that works on that, with other companies. So we have all of our internal instant messaging done that way because I think it's more secure than AOL or Yahoo or MSN Messenger. And we actually agreed with other companies to put our domain together enough that those instant messengers could be done, and we're doing video conferencing that way. It's a very, very nice tool, but I'm trying to picture how I can help small firms roll this out, which I think is important. And you're absolutely right. The new web tool from Microsoft, I've been using since it was in beta, and frankly, it's better in some ways and worse in some ways. I'm not sure, you know, Front Page 2000 wasn't better than maybe some of the things that we're seeing in the new products. So I think there's some confused direction there. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. In terms of the Office 2007, though, I do agree with all of you. I do believe it's revolutionary because it is not like what we have seen in Office since Office was first put together as a suite. And it is going to take training to get that job done right in terms of users jumping on. So the caution there again remains. You just don't want to throw that in front of people without training. And there are spot issues in integration with Office 2007, even on the gold code, still seeing those spot issues. So I think we're going to have minor application incompatibilities, but there may be more major issues that we just haven't seen yet.
Well, we're so deeply at the accounting firm level, we're so deeply involved with Excel and Word, you know, in our audit process, in our financial statements, you know, in our checklists, all of this integration between our engagement products and our research products and things. This is really deep, 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 deep stuff. There's all these templates out there, you know, and things like that. We're going to have, I mean, people are going to run into some brick walls when they start moving over to that. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. In fact, the audit managers in general, the CCH engagements, the K-squares, the, you know, engagement CSs, the PPCE tool, of all of those products, I think will have their share of stumbling blocks, even in the best of situations. And as you just pointed out, what do we primarily use in the CPA firms? We're primarily using that Excel, the Word, the Outlook, kind of, let's say, three or so of the, what is it, 41 now Microsoft Office modules officially?
Do you guys see, I mean, one of the sleepers in there that most people don't even know about is Groove. Brent, tell me about how Groove got there. You know that story.
Well, Dave actually had it right initially when he called Groove an IM product, because there is presence information available in Groove. Groove is is a product that they purchased, essentially.
Well, they purchased Ray Ozzie and got Groove with it, right?
That's essentially right. And Ray Ozzie became, I don't remember what his official title is, Chief Software or something. And Groove is a peer-to-peer sharing product, which allows for workspaces, if you will, that can be set up and files that can be shared across those workspaces. So the application in an accounting firm would be to communicate with clients and transfer files back and forth for QuickBooks data files, although I understand there are some difficulties with QuickBooks data files in Groove.
There are. That is true. But it's more than just transferring files. It's actually working on having concurrent access to files, right?
That's right.
So now, but there's a let's make sure we distinguish this between the publish feature in Excel. How would you implement the publish feature in Excel in a small firm?
You got me on that one.
Okay, that's basically a feature that allows you to take your Excel worksheet that you're creating and place it in a workspace that's available to everybody on your network.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Greg, you know, I know about that feature. I've used it in the beta, and honestly, for a small firm, I just don't see them having the technology available to support the publish feature because of the Excel server. So to me, if SBS, the small business server, evolves so that feature becomes part of the SBS pack, great, then the small firms will wind up using it. But until that type of integration occurs, and frankly I don't see that very likely, then unfortunately there's going to be features of the new Office system, as Microsoft prefers to call it, that small firms just won't have access to, frankly, wouldn't pay for the implementation and other issues as well.
Sure. But, I mean, early on we talked about this home server. And if home server grows up and becomes a server that small firms can use, you know, then, you know, they've got this, it's kind of a peer-to-peer on steroids. Public folder kind of a function. But there's lots of ways to skin a cat, so they could do that, or they could use, there's nothing to say you can't use Groove to share things essentially locally, right, Brent?
Well, that's right. And the other thing that I'm wondering about and will be interested to see is what pieces of Exchange 2007 get implemented into the next iteration of Small Business Server, because we may very well see, you know, Live Communication Server and Office Communicator clients as part of the next SBS suite.
Right.
Yeah, that would be my expectation and hope that it happens more quickly rather than less.
My prediction is that you're going to see more and more small firms outsourcing Exchange. The prices are falling dramatically. There are firms out there for $12 a month that will provide full Exchange, unlimited mailbox, RPC over HTTP, full Exchange, copy of Outlook if you don't have it, with spam control for $12.95 a month per mailbox. And that's a jaw-dropping price.
And really, when you think about it, that combination with a home server-type product in a small accounting firm is a real winning combination.
Exactly. One more topic here, and we got to wrap up. We're going to kind of start to run out of time here. We want to talk a little bit about some of these scan products. A year and a half ago or so, there was a new product that came on the market called BockDip. We all made fun of the acronym Bag of Crap Document Information Program. Or document indexing program, I think it was, but it was built by an accounting firm down in Florida, and basically takes a whole stack of tax work papers or tax information, W-2s, K-1s, interest, dividends, all that sort of stuff, and A-scans it, de-speckles, de-skews, all of that stuff, eliminates the multiple sides, does all of the magic stuff, and then organizes it in bookmarked fashion in the appropriate order that the 1040 appears. Pretty magic stuff. People looked at it. Everybody was pretty impressed with it. CCH was so impressed with it, they bought it, mercifully renamed it. It's called ProFX Scan now. Got some really great tools with it called PD Flyer. Have you guys all seen this product?
We own it.
Right. Okay, you own it. Last year, we all voted on it, and I don't know how you guys voted. I certainly voted for one of our innovation awards. It did receive one of our innovation awards last year. And now following that, Lacerte rolled out a product. SurePrep rolled out products, and they not only do the same thing, scan and put everything in order, but they actually OCR the numbers and drop the numbers directly onto the tax return. What the heck is going on here?
Integration.
We now have computers preparing tax returns. Probably doing a better job than juniors.
Actually, Greg, what I think we're seeing is a revolution in document management that is actually built around how accounting firms work. I've looked recently at maybe a dozen of these document management solutions, all of which were becoming much more accounting centric. The works in progress binder concept coming into it as in addition to wrapping up binder, and in addition to the old archiving solutions, we're just seeing this whole category get better. And then the other part of that is that it's going online. Increasingly, this is going to be a web-based activity where you have, folks like the folks at RIA who now have secure facilities, dual facilities, where everything's backed up automatically. And they've got GoFile,
which actually has a product. It's called TaxFlow that does same kind of thing all online.
And you're going to see more of that. We're seeing solutions, specific solutions for document management for Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, and others. So I really think we're looking at a revolution here, and a revolution, interestingly, built around the PDF standard, which for a long time everybody thought somehow that Adobe owned, and it turns out to be a public standard, and now everyone's jumping into the fray, including Microsoft, which makes it a standard option in Office 2007.
Well, the interesting thing to me is, we looked at BACDIP a year ago, and we gave it an innovation award, and immediately, in fact, during that process, we'd voted and selected the product, and before we were able to actually hand them the award, CCH bought it, so CCH got the award. I think much to the chagrin of some of their competitors, but so that happened, and then immediately you saw this the Thompson response with TaxFlow. You saw SurePrep. You saw Lacerte. SurePrep came up with this thing that's really pretty full featured, that SurePrep Express. Randy, have you seen anybody running that?
I have actually, and it's been interesting because realistically, there's four or five competitors. Five is the way I actually wind up counting these right now that are all working pretty well. And
the fifth would be Docket?
That's correct.
Okay. So and we've got Docket, the Canadian company.
Yes.
And GoFile Room, TaxFlow.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha.
So what's happening is actually I know of firms on all five of the products that are happy with pretty much all five for what they're doing. So it is pretty much a revolution of document processing and workflow, truly taking something that's been a pretty painful process for a lot of CPA firms and making it easier. And frankly, for even small firms, I think many of these offerings are affordable enough compared to the labor that they've been using in the past the firms that I talk to tell me on complex returns they're saving somewhere between 20 and 40 minutes of return.
Sure.
And that.
So Randy, you're not including the Lacerte product in your big five, so to speak.
Actually, I do have Lacerte in those five.
Okay, well, maybe we ought to list the five then, because I'm getting more than five.
We have ProFX Scan.
Yep.
Yes.
We have the Lacerte product, and let's talk about the Lacerte product, because Intuit did almost what I would call a defensive move. They introduced a product that I think does a nice job, but it recognizes, I believe, six different forms. So, it is certainly not extensive in terms of its OCR recognition capabilities. It's certainly a V1 product as compared to the SurePrep product that recognizes well over 100. This recognizes six. On the other hand, those six are the W-2s and K-1s and things like that, so they probably cover 80% of the forms. But that's the Lacerte product, and then we have the SurePrep product. And then the Docket has a product inside their document management product that scans and organizes. And inside GoFileRoom, there is the TaxFlow product. So those are the five.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, Randy, let's go back. You were talking about some firms that were using these and their thoughts.
Yeah, and basically I've had very few firms that have had complained. They basically believed that they got what they paid for or more, and so far the reactions are favorable. Again, the reduction in time, the improvement in consistency, very, very important. The additional tools, like you'd mentioned, the PDF flyer and the CCH scan for the annotations and the electronic Eddy machine tapes to be additional stickies in the process. The training or learning curve being relatively short. The biggest issue for most firms is just being able to get the vendor to come in and install and train them on the product in short order because the demand has been so high.
Right.
I want to make a quick comment about
sure, go ahead.
The CCH product just because I have
sure.
a lot of experience with it.
You get a lot of blood on the floor trying to get it going.
Pretty much. The thing that I've noticed is the scan, the CCH scan engine, what was the BockDip engine, consumes so much resource that it can bring a production server to its knees when it's running that engine.
Oh, it's an application too. It runs as an application, not
it
as
runs,
a server.
It runs as an application, and CCH of course has said that they're going to re-engineer it, and it's going to run as a service, which would be wonderful because, we finally dedicated a machine to that scan engine just so that it didn't affect other applications on another production server.
Absolutely required.
Let me pop in here. If there are listeners who are particularly interested in the ProFX scan, BockDip, and exactly what's happening there, if you're listening to this, you're obviously seeing all of the rest of the podcasts that are available on the CPA Technology Advisor. If you just scan down a little bit, I did a fairly extensive podcast interview with Mark Ryburn, who was actually with the CPA firm. He's the father of this product and now a product manager with CCH. And we talked about that issue and lots of others at some length just a couple of months ago. So you might want to go tune into that. But there certainly are problems with it. One of them is the application versus service. What else is happening?
Well, another one that's pretty clear is the documents can only be resolved at 300 dots per inch. And there's still quite a bit of, I think, misinformation in the industry on this, 200 versus 300 versus 600 and so forth. But CCH Scan basically only works at 300 dots per inch this year, which means if you're trying to use a higher resolution in your storage, you can't do it with these documents. They're going to come in at 300.
It'll only support a TIFF format too, won't it?
That's correct currently. And realistically, what they're doing is a forms recognition as opposed to an OCR recognition. And you've already heard from our prior discussion that several of these products are actually doing text recognition, which is a quite different strategy. So there's going to be a little bit of, I'll say, evolution of the products as they either do a pure form or a text or maybe a blend of the two in their strategy.
That's really a second generation. That LACERT product and the SurePrep product are second generations to the BachDip and the Docket and the Scan the Text Flow products. Or they would be kind of like V1, and these other products are V2. Is that a good way to think of it?
I think it's not a bad way to think of it. You know, as I've watched some of these products do this maturation where they're actually doing the OCR recognition, it's clear that they can recognize more types of forms. We're seeing the evolution now over into, for example, brokerage statement forms to be able to recognize those. And, of course, the next logical step, as you've already pointed out with LACERT, being able to pick up the numbers, we know that's on the radar for CCH scan. We know it's in process and partially done for Docket and so forth. So, you know, that will become another new exciting feature that we'll probably talk even more about over the next year.
Well, that's exactly where we're at. We're going to have to talk about those things over the next year. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much for being a part of the inaugural edition, number one of Tech2Go. We will record monthly until our listeners tell us we need to do more. I've enjoyed this immensely, guys. Thanks very, very much. Brent, specifically, thanks to you. David, thank you so very much for joining us. Brent had to get up early. David's time for your lunch. Randy, I know you've been out all week and specifically made time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Greg.
It's been
absolutely a pleasure. Let's do this again next month.
We're very pleased to have you all along as listeners. And again, if you've got questions or comments of things you'd like to hear, I'm sure Greg will talk more about that here.
Exactly. And we'll have contact information in the notes. So if you need some follow-up, feel free. I can't promise you that you'll get a personal answer from everybody, but my guess is that wouldn't be surprised. Again, Tech2Go, inaugural version number one. Tune in next month, same time, same place, as a podcast. Tell your friends. Thank you very much.
That wraps up this edition of Tech2Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust.
Tech2Go for January 2007 has been brought to you by the CPA Technology Advisor. Visit cpatechadvisor.com for more great podcast programs from the intersection of technology and public accounting.